From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and every week we bring you interesting individuals from the world of sports medicine and health in general, and today, again, is no exception. We are privileged to have Dr. John Welty Peachy with us today on the podcast. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, and as we do every week, I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction, tell people why you're here. Talk a little bit about you, and then we'll just jump into the conversation.
Sounds good.
Dr. Welty Peachy is currently an assistant professor of sports management in our division of sports management here in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M. His PhD is in sports management from the University of Connecticut. Dr. Welty Peachy has a really interesting and diverse background. He was a former vice president for the International Operations and Program Development at the Institute for International Sport in Kingston, Rhode Island. He has done a variety of different athletic things over his life. He was a national-level bicyclist at one point. He actually ran on two legs across America, which we are going to start off with in a minute. And recently he's been honored. It's a little bit bittersweet for us. We wanted to hurry and get him on the podcast because he will be leaving Texas A&M soon to go to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where he is going to be one of the key cogs in the development of the Center for Sport for Development and Social Change. And so thank you again for taking the time, John, to be with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Let's start with the run across America. You actually ran across the United States.
We did. A buddy of mine and I did that, and it actually was sort of the impetus that sparked my interest in working in what we call sport for development or social change. So now this was a while ago, so I definitely couldn't do it anymore, but my buddy and I, we were marathoners in college and did a lot of running, but also both of us had a strong interest in social justice.
Okay.
And something that we were both very, very passionate about and interested in, particularly with issues regarding homelessness.
Okay.
And had both done some volunteering and work with that. And so our senior year, we started to sit around, as you do when you're seniors, and pondering, what are you going to do with your life, after you're done? And one night, late at night in the dorm room, we concocted this idea. It's like, well, how could we use our running to try to make some type of difference in society? Is there a way that we could do that? And then we started thinking about, has anybody run across the country before? Has anybody run from the West Coast to the East Coast? And there were a few, but so we said, well, could we do that and use it as a way to raise awareness about homeless issues in the United States? So we approached a couple of organizations that worked with homelessness in a couple of cities, and they said, "Yeah, we'll sponsor you. We'll be on board with that." And so we got sponsors and got donations, and ran from Portland, Oregon, to Boston, Massachusetts, through sort of a circuitous route. Did about 4,000 miles.
Wow.
Over about 5.5 months, and spoke a lot in communities and schools and in the media and such to use sport as a vehicle to call attention to the plight of the homeless.
Well, that's kind of an interesting approach, and I'm not sure, I think it wasn't until I met you that I'd ever even thought about doing that. But, you use the phrase cause-related sporting event in some of your writing, which is really much what you were talking about here when you were running for a cause in this case. How can sport affect society like that?
Well, it's we always say it can, but it can't do it in a vacuum. And so we say that sport has some type of power. Sport has something that we identify with that is why we all love it, I guess, and we're in it in whatever fashion that we are, whether it's management or coaching or being an athlete or sports medicine or whatever it is. There's something that draws us to it. It's very visible. It's something that we highly identify with. And that can be a very powerful thing. to create awareness. But it also, through participation, it can be a very powerful thing, not just through the health benefits that you gain, mm-hmm. the fitness benefits that you gain, but through the other outcomes that can happen through sport participation, such as increased self-esteem, creation of social networks mm-hmm. that you didn't have mm-hmm. before, increased belief that you can do something and succeed. We call that self-efficacy. Right. So sport can play a role in producing some of these outcomes, not just by itself, mm-hmm. as we always say, but it has some capacity to do that. And so it can be a really interesting tool to use when you think about how can we affect society or how can we help society to help with various development agendas, whether it's, you know, helping people that are marginalized or homeless mm-hmm. or immigrants or others that are disadvantaged, using sport to help reconnect them to society mm-hmm. and then that being the impetus to get them more reengaged, mm-hmm. Whether it's using it as a peace mechanism in a third world country overseas, whether it's using it in a community development capacity in communities that need programs to help build a community cohesion and various infrastructures and things. So, but we always say it can't be just the only thing that you do. Right. You know, it has to be partnered with other social service projects and stuff. But it can be one cog that can help to create positive change in society.
So it's just not a one-time effort.
No, it's not a one-time effort.
Then the effort goes away and nothing
right.
happens. Yeah.
And it's just not saying that sport is the best and the only tool that you can use to make society better.
Right.
We're saying it is a tool. Okay. And if we use sport with other things, other, we call them engines of development or other ways, mm-hmm. It can be something that can reach people that we might not be able to reach before.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, I've done a lot of work with sport and homelessness.
Okay.
And particularly
come back to the homeless.
Sport
yeah.
soccer, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And using soccer to help homeless folks. And
well, let's give a plug out to this.
Street Soccer USA.
Street Soccer USA. And we'll put links on that to in our show notes. Yeah.
That we've done a lot of work with. And it's an organization based in New York City under the umbrella of Help USA that works in 20 cities around the United States and uses soccer as a means to help homeless folks basically make positive changes in their lives and get off the streets.
Hmm.
And so we've been doing some research projects with them over the years, which we can talk about. But
so the participants in this are primarily
homeless
individuals?
Folks, yeah, and homeless folks. And they play on teams in the cities and participate in recreational soccer leagues for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And the coaches are volunteers. Often the coaches for the teams might be caseworkers at social service agencies and such. And the impetus is using soccer here to reach out to a set of homeless folks that have shunned sometimes other forms of intervention and have not engaged with that.
Right.
But all of a sudden, here is something that, I used to play soccer in high school. You know, I was pretty good. Maybe I can do that again or something like that. And so it kind of reaches, a set of folks that sometimes traditional programs, when you think about outreach, different programs miss in some respects. So it helps to kind of reengage them. But it's not the only program that they need to be part of. But
right.
It's something that provides a hook. Mm-hmm. Brings them in,
mm-hmm.
and then through that, then they're connected to other forms of social services.
It's an entree into other stuff.
Right,
yeah.
That are really, really important. But the sport is sort of the impetus. So we found some really encouraging things in our research that we've been doing with them over the years. Outcomes of this, and such as that through this engagement, through, say, homeless folks, men and women,
mm-hmm.
and youth, playing in soccer, it does a couple of things over time.
Mm-hmm.
It helps to build the self-esteem and confidence that one needs again,
mm-hmm.
which you lose when you're on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And that's really important for mm-hmm. being able to have the motivation to do anything,
right.
To get a job, to want to get off the streets,
mm-hmm.
To want to further your education. And so that's really important. It also builds trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something
that... Because you especially have to trust the people you play with and the people that organize it.
And the people that you're working
sure,
with.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that is lost when you end up being on the streets is that trust in humanity that perhaps we all take for granted,
mm-hmm.
but that can be lost.
Mm.
And there was a really neat quote that one of the homeless players talked about when I was talking with him, and he said, through playing on this team, it's helped me to reengage with humanity.
Mm.
And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about, say, you're on the streets, you kind of lose touch with, in some ways, what it means to be, you know, a part of humanity, the human race.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have some of the things that we all take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And then through this experience, that started to reconnect this individual back into humanity. I think that's really powerful. And that, I think, shows what, in this instance, sport or soccer can do to help reach out, help form those connections again, those networks. But it can't just stop there.
Yeah.
No, it's what happens after that. You know, the follow-up and how we connect them into various social services that are needed and such. But sometimes that just feeling good about yourself again.
Sure, yeah.
No, it can be what the starting point that's needed.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting point. We interviewed a guy named John Fox a few months ago, who wrote a book called The Ball, which talks about the role of play primarily in culture. And that's what he talks about, is these big multiplayer games that they had in the old, say, old Europe, where it was like the communities would play against each other. Mm-hmm. So they were like 300 people on a team. And they still do that to some extent. And it provides such a connection point for everyone in the community. And so this is, I'm hearing, that's what you're saying with these kinds of outreach efforts. It helps reconnect people back with the community.
It does. It helps reconnect them.
To humanity, for that matter.
To humanity.
Yeah.
But you also have to pay attention to how it's done. And that's something that is really important, that really like to stress, is it's not just doing sport how it's typically done might not be the best way to go about it. So you have to pay attention when you're, say, using sport in a development capacity about how you do it.
Okay.
The processes and mechanisms are really important. So, for instance, we observed street soccer has a national tournament each year. It began in Washington, D.C., and now it's held in New York City. And they play the finals at Times Square, which is really cool.
Yeah.
I think all these homeless guys running around and women in Times Square playing soccer. And so it really calls attention and awareness to it. But anyhow, our first year we started this research project. We went to the Cup in D.C. and interviewing players about their experiences before and after. And we observed during the matches that there were some losses that were like 12-0, 15-0, you know, really lopsided losses. And, you know, we talked to these players afterwards, like after the event, and they were just like despondent. You know, just discouraged, saying, you know, this, we just got, you know, this weren't, it just did nothing for their self-esteem and self-confidence.
Right.
And started to think, you know what, with a development agenda, when you're trying to help people feel better about themselves, we may need to think about how we use sport.
Right.
You know, is that what we want? You know, 12-0 losses, 15-0 losses.
Yeah.
And so we started to talk with the organization about looking at how do you structure this? You know, what can we give medals to everybody, you know, regardless of whether you win or lose? Can you recognize participation more in some ways? Can you make it so that just being here, you know, being in the experience is rewarded and important, immaterial of what the outcome is, win or loss. And so they did a lot of things to change that.
Yeah.
And I think over the years, that's become more engaging and minimizing those 12-0 losses, which really do nothing. We all hate that.
Right.
You know,
well, some competition is good, but too much kills what you want
to
do.
Particularly in this context.
Yeah.
And so you have to pay attention to, and that's what we're trying to determine with research now, is what are the best ways to organize sport to achieve developmental outcomes.
Okay.
You know, so we know that there can be positive outcomes, but now what are the best ways that we can do that? What are the mechanisms and the processes that we should use for that?
You know, this conversation may be maybe foreign to some people. I mean, they may not have thought about it in this way, but in reality, I almost think that almost most adult-related exercise nowadays seems to be organized around this. I mean, I constantly hear of people, you know, will you sponsor me because I'm going to go try to run a marathon for leukemia.
Sure.
Or we're going to do this for this cause. There was a 24-hour walkathon a few weeks ago about to offset cancer. And so it seems like this, without us knowing it, has actually become the overriding reason why people, adults in particular, do any kind of activity.
Well, you know, I think we like to be associated with positive things. If you think that humanity is good, right? And you see that in disasters, you know, just like with the tornadoes up in Oklahoma recently. And sometimes it takes a crisis to pull people together and to want to do something. But if we operate from the assumption that, no, we're good people, and we do want to help others, And I think you're right. I think we're seeing more and more of people in sport or physical fitness or activity thinking about, well, how can we, you know, how can I be motivated to do something that's actually going to make a difference, perhaps?
Right.
Or, you know, get those, like my daughter just did the jump rope for heart, right? Mm-hmm. So getting all the sponsors from the grandparents and the mm-hmm. parents. That's great. You know, that's one way that we can engage and such. So it happens on multiple levels, you yeah. know, I think. And I think we're starting to recognize that a little bit more.
Well, it's interesting that people won't be motivated to do these things for their own health. I mean, you can tell them all day long, this will make you healthier, mm-hmm. live longer, yada, yada. And yet you say, which you can help people have breast cancer or whatever, and they go, okay, great. Mm-hmm. I'll go ask people for money, and then I'll go do this myself. It's kind of an interesting paradox to some extent.
Yeah.
We won't help ourselves, but we'd rather help each other.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's, again, points to the goodness of the human race in some respects. So, and how can sport fit into that?
You know, one of the, I guess to change the discussion a little bit, one of the things that you've done is you put together a book or DVD, I believe, on how parents could work with their children in sports. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that for a little bit, because, you know, when I talk to people that have kids in sports, one of the things they say, if we could get rid of the parents, we'd be doing okay, kind of part of that. What advice do you have for parents that have children that are in sports of some kind? There's an open-ended question for
you.
Yeah,
very, very much so, as my daughter is just sort of moving into that, so I should speak to myself. Well, I say primarily, you know, it has to be, what is the real reason that your child is in sports? You know, is it for you or is it for them, for him or her?
Good question.
And if it's for you, then if you're trying to live vicariously, there's a big word, but if you're trying to live through the accomplishments sure. of your child,
yeah.
you know, and whatever it is, whether it's sport, music, art, whatever, then we can have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we get into the position of parents doing wild and crazy and wacky things, mm-hmm. which we read about, that mm-hmm. happens at Little League contests and Pee Wee football and youth sports, and coaches, you know, trying to live through, reignite or rekindle our, you know, passion for sports in our playing days that we yeah. had in high school or college. And so we have to separate that a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the key pieces of advice that I would have, and I think that others would have, is we have to separate that out. And we have to, you know, allow our children to explore too, and not push them too hard into one thing
yeah.
that is what you want them to do,
right.
because then we lead to burnout and dropout, lack of fun, which is the main reason that kids drop out of health and fitness and sport.
Mm-hmm.
Push them too soon to specialize, and all of a sudden by age 14, 15, 16, 17, they're done.
Right.
And they want anymore
right.
to do it, because it was dad's passion, or
right.
it was mom's passion to be a gymnast. It
right.
wasn't my passion
right.
for it. So that's where we have to be really careful. So I think it's looking at that separation a little bit, really trying to identify what your child's really interested in, providing those opportunities for them, and then stepping back and let them strive and fail and make their own mistakes and learn, and let them have that experience, and that you don't have to control it.
And they're valuable lessons in them failing.
Very valuable lessons. Because
yeah.
we all, that's what sport's about. Because
yeah.
nobody wins all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all fail.
Except me.
Except you, yeah.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, it's definitely not me.
No, not me for sure.
Yeah, and it's a good lesson to learn. I mean,
yeah.
because life is full of successes and failures. And then we use those failures to learn from. And then hopefully we improve what we do and move forward. But we all have them.
Yeah.
And we have to, as parents, let our child's fail.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do sometimes.
Well, here's a tough question. So as adults who may have children, how do we help other parents understand that? Whether we're coaches of the team or whether we're just another parent
mm-hmm.
that has children on the same team, and we've got another adult that's going nuts. I mean, how do we help them understand what you've just said?
Well, I think there's a number of ways. We can't be afraid to confront. I think sometimes we don't take action when we see behavior. If we're a parent sitting in the stands and we see another parent acting inappropriately, that
right.
it's easy for us not to do anything.
Right. Right.
Be passive.
Right. You know, don't want to get involved.
Don't want to get involved.
Yeah.
But maybe we should. Okay. And maybe we should get involved and say something in a respectful way, of course, that we're not being antagonistic.
Yeah.
We don't want to fight in the stands or anything, but in some ways to call attention to that. There are some leagues around the country that are starting to put together codes of ethics and conduct for not just at a variety of levels, for officials, for players, and for fans, and for parents. And some leagues that will have parents sign these codes of conduct, codes of ethics, prior to seasons, so that they know what is expected of them in terms of behavior when they're sitting in the stands or when they're interacting during little Joey's, little Susie's event.
Yeah,
right. So that's a more formalized way.
Right.
But I think it's not being the main thing is not being passive, and that's a hard thing.
Right.
You know,
right.
To be able to confront somebody, but to do it in a respectful way, because we all see it.
Right.
And, you know, when you're in the stands and you're at the game or the event, and you and I'm guilty of this as well. You know, we don't do anything. You know, we let it go on.
Right. It's easy to do.
Easy to do.
Easy to do. Yeah, hard. It's hard to stand up and do the right thing sometimes. Well, speaking of doing the right thing, you mentioned very briefly at the beginning about the use of sport in world peace.
Mm-hmm.
Give us some examples of that. That
sure.
May sound to some people listening like this big airy fairy kind of wow.
Sure. Let me give some context, and I'll give a specific example.
Okay.
It's actually how the Olympic Games were formed.
Hmm.
When you think back to not Pierre de Coubertin, who brought back the Olympic Games as we know them now, but when you think back to the ancient Greek model of the Olympics back in ancient times. Sport was supposed to be not just sport, but the original Olympic Games were competitions in sport, in the cultural arts, in oratory, in poetry, in music, and dance, as well as running and athletics. But it was supposed to be a celebration of humanity and a way for us to work at getting along.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the Olympic motto today, the Olympic creed that Pierre de Coubertin brought back, it's still there. It's still there. But beyond that, now there are organizations that are developing a specific mandate to use sport for working at peace. Mm-hmm. And let me give you one specific example, because it's actually an organization that I worked for a number of years, which you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, which is the World Scholar Athlete Games, which is an Olympic-style event, which is held every 4 years, that brings together roughly about 2,000 young people from 180 countries around the world to take part in sport activities and cultural arts activities.
Mm.
So we have contests in your typical Olympic sports, you know, track and field and basketball and volleyball and all that, but as well as in symphony, dance, choir, theater, those types of things. So going back to the original Olympic model.
Sure.
But the mission of this organization is to use sport in the fine arts, cultural arts, to help bridge and work at peace between the youth of the world and to foster that understanding, reduce stereotypes and prejudice and et cetera. But they do a very unique approach to this, and this gets back to the how we organize sport. So unlike the Olympic Games, where we have country versus country competition, right? So the U.S. against China, you know, and U.S. versus Canada, and we love to root for our country. This organization takes all these 2,000 athletes and mixes them up on teams.
Oh, really? Huh. Interesting.
And so a soccer team might have players on it from 10 different countries.
Hmm.
You know, a basketball team might have players on it from U.S., China, Russia, South Africa, Indonesia. And the organization pays special attention to putting on the same team young people from parts of the world that are in conflict, like South Korea and North Korea.
Interesting.
Or Palestinians and Jews.
Jews.
And so then using that team-based model of having to work together in a competition format with trained coaches who are facilitators to work at those goals of conflict resolution, stereotype reduction, working at forming bonds of friendship that with people that we've not necessarily interacted with before, that we have stereotypes about or perceived that there are certain ways, you know, these are our enemies per se, but now we're playing on the same team with a common goal. And that's fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, I think the outcomes of that are really fascinating. And it gets back to how do we organize sport to achieve those goals? So, and that's just one example of an organization that is changing how we think about sport mm-hmm. and how we can use it. So mm-hmm. using that then to help to work at peace issues around the world. I think that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. We think so often of sport in the term of just athletic competition. My team won, your team lost, mm-hmm. whatever. So it's really cool to find out about ways that we can use sport to actually develop peace and collaboration amongst a bunch of different people, as well as social causes as
sure.
well.
Sure. And I think that's really important. I mean, there's a place for all parts of sport. You know, professional sport, intercollegiate sport are important in this country, and they give us hope and they give us many things. But within that, then we can look at ways that sport can be used for other things.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to consider and for us all to think about, that this thing that we love can really be a positive influence in society. And we see so much negativity these days, I think, with regards to ethical conduct in sport at all levels.
Right.
We read, the media loves to grab onto those issues, and sometimes we see less about the positive things that are going on. There are thousands of nonprofits around the world that are using sport in very positive ways, and we just don't know about them,
mm-hmm.
and we don't hear about them, but they're there. And we need to call those to light. And I think they're doing really powerful things.
Is there a centralized website we can go to pull
those?
There
is, actually. Sportfordevelopment.org is a website that has pulled together a lot of the research and a lot of the organizations that work what we call in sport for development, or how we use sport for social change. And it's a easy lay language type of website where you can go and see what's going on and what the organizations are that are working around the country and around the world, not just around the world, but in the United States. There are many organizations that are working in the inner cities or working in rural parts of the country in Appalachia and others that are using sport with some type of development mandate. And so this is a website that kind of showcases some of those things that are going on, as well as some of the research that's been done that's showing how these organizations are actually impacting society.
Super.
And I think that's important.
Well, we'll certainly put that up on our web notes, and we encourage everybody to visit it, look around, become something part of bigger than yourself, right?
That's right.
Yeah. John, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
We've kind of run short on time here, and as we do every week, we ask our guests to give us a take-home message. What's the one thing that you would like people to remember?
I think to think broader about what sport can be.
Mm, interesting. Great. Great take-home message. Thank you so much for
being
here.
You're very
welcome. And as always, also with our take-home message, it's always followed by our podcast question of the week. And so with our podcast question this week is our producer, Cheryl.
What sport organization does Dr. Welty Peachy work closely with to help the homeless?
Super question. Be the first one to email us the correct answer to that to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. And you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts that we have. And I keep saying, and it's getting true now, is that hurry up, because those second edition T-shirts are about to run out. We're going to have the third edition out in the next couple months. So, again, thank you, Dr. Welty Peachy.
You're very welcome.
Best of luck at the University of Illinois.
Thank you very much.
And we'll miss you here.
I will miss being
here. Yeah. And thank you all for taking the time to download and listen with us today. We hope that you join us next week for another interesting person in the world of sports medicine and human performance. Until then, we hope that you have an active and healthy week.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, and our music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.